Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello and welcome to If You Love This Planet. Today I'm speaking with Dr. John Wright, the Executive Advisor to CSIRO's Sustainable Energy Partnership. CSIRO stands for Australia's Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organisation, and it has been going for at least, I would say, 50 years. It's a very important organisation in Australia. They've just released a new publication designed to educate people on how to save energy, to save money, and to reduce your carbon footprint. The study or publication is called the CSIRO Home Energy Saving Book, published by Pan Macmillan in Australia in 2009. Dr. John Wright and the book's two other authors, Dr. Peter Osman and Peter Ashworth, are leading experts on climate change and sustainable living. Dr. Wright's career spans more than 30 years in the public and private sectors, and he's one of Australia's foremost scientists in the field of alternative energy and greenhouse mitigation. And he joins me now. Dr. John Wright, welcome to If You Love This Planet.
Good morning, Helen. It's lovely to talk to you about this book.
Yes. I think it's a very timely subject. Well, I don't think I know, because the energy bill is up now before the US House and Senate. The House has passed it with a lot of deviations, I think, and additions put in by oil companies and coal companies, and the nuclear industry is trying to get billions of dollars of support in this energy bill, which really violates what the bill is all about. It will go to the Senate, I'm not sure quite when, but I think fairly soon. And so what we talk about today is totally relevant in all countries of the world, particularly the developed countries. I found your book extremely accessible and really applicable to the ordinary person in their home and in their daily life. So would you like to just, Dr. Wright, summarize in a few sentences what the book is really all about? That's hard, but, you know, see if you can.
Well, I will try. I should say, I think, something about the motivation for this book.
Yes.
And it happened a few years ago now. I tell a story in the book, in the foreword, that I was with a group of other energy experts and business people delivering a series of public lectures.
Yeah.
And there's about 900 people that turned up, which shows the interest in energy in this country, and I assume it's the same in other developed countries at the moment. And during, we were talking about all the fancy ways of reducing greenhouse gas emissions in particular. And in the question time, a little boy stood up, very young. I estimated he was about 8 years old. I could be totally wrong, but he was just a small lad. And he said, "What can I do?"
Huh.
Now, that's a pretty deep question, I think. And I must admit, I was unprepared for it and gave a fairly weak response. Now, my wife was in that audience,
yeah,
being a public group. And afterwards, she said, "Well, that was okay, but in question time, you did not answer that little boy's question."
Yeah.
And, you know, I blustered a bit over that. But I had to agree with her that he did not get the answer that he deserved. And it's rankled with me ever since that perhaps we should be doing a little bit more than we have been up to now in involving and assisting the general public in what is a crucial area of our economy, and that's energy supply and the way we use that energy. And so that's where it started.
Yeah.
And I went and spoke to our chief executive and said, look, we'd like to put out a book which is very well researched, that has the CSIRO label on it, a very well-respected research organisation in Australia and known around the world. And we want to come out with a book for the public that will allow the public to, if you like, not feel as powerless in front of all the huge changes that are going on.
Mm.
And we all know that as we move further down the track, that the upward pressures on energy prices are going to continue. And we can either sit back and just let it happen, or we can take charge and exert some control over our lives and the way we use energy in the home.
Good. And I've read most of the book, and I'm very impressed with it. And I think the basic principles are totally applicable to the American population as well. I'm not sure if there's a similar book available in the United States. I know that a lot of people are deeply concerned about global warming and where it's going, and how the Congress is, as we'd say, dickering around with the legislation that's necessary to really save the planet, let alone the economy and the like. So I'll tell people at the end of this interview how to get the book and to read it with eyes that could be used for the American situation. So let's now I want you then, John Wright, to summarize the various topics that you deal with in the book, please, in a simple way.
Okay. Well, it's broken up into obviously a number of chapters. There are 11 chapters, starting from facts about greenhouse and people's carbon footprint, right to the various ways the householder can save energy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's taken in three parts. Simple things you can do that don't cost you anything, that is going to save energy and lower your overall energy bill. The second phase are things that you can do which cost you some outlay, but that cost would be recoverable within a year or perhaps a couple of years.
Mm.
So you have to do a small outlay for a continuing saving. And the third part is if the householder really wants to perhaps go over the top with the aim of reducing their footprint, that's going to cost them money, and perhaps they'll never actually recover that investment in the end, but at least you will have the satisfaction of knowing that you have done something about your own greenhouse gas emissions.
Yes.
So the book covers all of those, and then it gives you a little bit on where we think the future is going to be and how that's all going to pan out.
Yes, I think I get a bit hung up about government and corporate concentration on how much it's going to cost the general household and industry the like about doing things to help to save the planet, where I know that the majority of Australians are prepared to spend more money to make sure their children have a safe future. And I'm fairly aware that most Americans feel that way too. I think we're approaching it from the wrong end, Dr. Wright. I think that people need to feel that they will give up some money to do the right thing for the earth, which is just what you implied, right?
That's exactly what I'm implying. But of course, we've got to deal, and we should deal with the spectrum of people who are going to be interested in this book. And let's face it, there are some people who are crucially concerned with the way that we're going, but might not have a lot of money to put towards it. And, you know, they have to live in the system that we set up at the moment. You can do all sorts of things to lobby for change, but this is something that you can do immediately.
Right.
Because a lot of the things that we're talking about, and in this country, we're starting to really go down the solar route. We're looking at all forms of energy efficiency, largely coming from the big end of town. And these things are going to take an awful long time still to put into place if we're going to radically change our energy supply system, put more renewables into the system. It's going to take a long time because these are big investments, and because we've got a lot of capital stock, which, using our current economics, is going to have to wind down. But these are things that you and I can do immediately.
That's right.
And I think that's important. So, you know, we can have an effect over the next few years rather than talking about decades.
Now, I'd like to deal with food first, because I think that most people have really no idea about the carbon footprint of food. I know that the average article of food in the United States travels 1,500 miles before it settles in a supermarket.
Yes.
Imagine the amount of fossil fuel that's used to transport that food, and also if it's requiring cooling and refrigeration, that's another huge amount of fossil fuel needed to provide the refrigeration. And then there's the packaging. Would you like to talk about those issues, Dr. Wright?
Yes, I'd love to, because this was a real eye-opener to us. I personally didn't realise just how much greenhouse gas emissions come from things such as goods and services and food.
Yeah.
Now, it's obvious when you think about it, but what this book has done, it's made us think about this to a depth that we wouldn't have normally done.
You mean new scientists?
Yeah, well, okay, let's call us new scientists. You get focused on things that are sort of big and spectacular, and perhaps miss the small things.
Yes.
When we looked at the greenhouse gas emission per person, Australia and America, for example, are probably the two highest greenhouse gas emitters per person per year on the planet. We knew that, of course, but when you break it down into what role or what responsibility, I don't like using that word, how much CO2 comes out of the average household?
Yes.
It is really quite large. In Australia, in the way that we've accounted for it, it's about 50 tonnes per statistically average household per year, which is an awful lot of greenhouse gas emission. And when you break that up, now this is a surprising bit.
Yeah.
When you break it up, only 17% of that greenhouse gas emission comes from the use of fuel in the house, gas, the hot water and cooking, and electricity.
Really?
Yeah, only 17% of that.
Huh.
The rest of it comes from, there's about 9% to fill your car up with petrol. There's about 11% for the housing maintenance and building materials. But a massive 29% comes from the food that you buy. And that comes from all the things that you mentioned, all the packaging and food miles and all that sort of stuff. And 30%, another 31%, comes from the goods and services that we buy.
Like what?
Well, if you buy a computer, for example, imagine all the greenhouse gas that's gone into making that. So in the end, it comes down to the end consumer. And interestingly, of course, there are things you can do about that.
Yep.
And that's really the key. But 29% coming from food is just an amazing figure. Well, and it's fairly obvious when you actually think about it. Now, I'll give you a little story.
All right. We like stories.
I have now become very conscious of this. And we don't have any really hard numbers on things such as food miles, how much an orange, what the equivalent greenhouse gas emissions are from an orange that you might eat. But in my local supermarket, I've noticed that grapes and oranges over the past few months have been out of season in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
And we're importing them. We're importing them from America.
Oh.
And you go around the supermarket shelves and there's all these navel oranges, lovely fruit, from California.
No, but I look at my navel oranges and they say made in Australia.
They do now, but, a few months ago they weren't.
Yeah.
That's because oranges have come into season in Australia.
Oh.
So you've got to watch the seasons. Cherries, beautiful cherries, all from America.
Yep.
And grapes. Now, grapes are just starting to appear on the shelves in supermarkets, and I saw Australian grapes the other day, but they're side by side with American grapes.
Well, we should ban imports of food, shouldn't we, in the light of global warming? I mean, imagine, I suppose they come by plane because they're perishable.
I don't know. Perhaps they come in frozen ships, I don't know.
We need to find that out, don't we?
I think there would be, there's been lots of studies, particularly in the UK, on food miles and greenhouse gas emissions. Now, I could be wrong, but I haven't seen any equivalent study in this country, but it'd certainly be worthwhile, I think.
Well, you know, in America, you can buy any food in any season that you want, and much of it's grown in Latin America and all over the world, and it's all imported. I mean, I think that this indulgence, I would call it self-indulgence, is long overdue to be stopped, because it's all, I mean, we should only eat the food that is grown in the season in the local area in which we live, right?
I think that's a lovely vision.
Yeah, but why can't we do it? I mean, I know we talk about globalization, which means that the huge food corporations have taken over the world and, you know, they decide what we eat, when we eat, where we eat it. But I think as you're talking, it seems fairly obvious we need to take the law into our own hands in a way.
Things are starting to happen here. I don't know about it in America, but now the supermarkets are putting up very obvious signs as to where the particular product comes from.
Mm.
Now, there's been a lot of controversy in this country about the importation of seafood, for example, from parts of Asia. And it's inevitably prawns, for example, shrimps, are always cheaper. The imported product is always cheaper than the Australian product. Now, I always buy the Australian product because I trust it. And I think it's better. But if you're, you know, a low-income person struggling, you might not be able to afford that. And I think that has to be taken into account too.
Well, why are they why are imported prawns, and that would be so, I'm sure, in the United States, cheaper than prawns grown in the United States or Australia?
I can't give you a full answer to that, but I can only estimate that they're produced by farming techniques and wages are lower. And, you know, their overall cost of production are lower than in a high-wage country like Australia.
Well, and I think we all should note that the prawns that are grown in Southeast Asia and the like, what they do is they remove the mangroves, which are basic essentials for the food chain in the sea where the fish are spawned, and then they make these sort of artificial ponds. They pour in fertilizer, they feed the prawns with fish meal coming from the fish in the sea, and they put other toxic substances in. And then what happens when that particular pond has been used and become sterile, they move on. And in that way, they're destroying huge acreages of mangrove swamps, which are essential to the health and well-being of the sea. And I think that we all should not eat imported prawns. I've been aware of this for some time, and I know that prawns are very easily obtainable in the United States. The local ones, I think a lot of them come from the Gulf near the Gulf of Mexico and the like. But anyway, I've got off the track. What about...
Well, it's an easy thing to get... get annoyed about.
Yeah.
But I don't know about you know, putting blanket bans and all that sort of stuff on it.
Why?
We have the power just not to buy it.
No, but that means massive education. And
it does.
That has to happen through the media. And who controls much of our media in Australia? Rupert Murdoch. And who controls much of the media that many people watch in the United States and listen to? Rupert Murdoch. So it's easier said than done to produce an educational system whereby every person, Mr. and Mrs. Brown, you know, anywhere they live, understand the implications of what we're talking about, Dr. Wright.
Yes. Well, I suppose part of the education process is this book we put out.
Yeah.
And believe me, it's been an education process for me and the authors and for CSIRO. which has been good.
Okay, I want to talk about that in a second. Talk about packaging, because when I go to get my food, my God, it's packaged in plastic,
yep,
or cardboard or styrofoam. Then it's packaged in more plastic, polyvinyl chloride, which leaks vinyl chloride into fatty food in particular, which is a potent carcinogen. And then not only do you buy it, but they put it all in a plastic bag. So it's sort of tripling the packaging. Would you like to comment about packaging, Dr. Wright?
Well, only in terms of, you get an engineer's response.
Oh, you, yes.
It's part of the goods and services wedge on the greenhouse gas emissions, and it's a big one. And, I think it would be better to, personal view, it would be better to use paper and cardboard as packaging and make sure you recycle that packaging when you use the product. I spent some time in America living there, and obviously most of my time in Australia, and there are some very good recycling activities going on, and we recycle something like 70% of our newsprint, for example.
Yeah.
It's not hard just to, when you get home, to separate out your paper products and recycle those. Mm. But I agree with you, it's annoying if a lot of that stuff is plastic.
Yeah.
And separating those paper and plastic and, putting one in one bin, one in another, the plastic inevitably gets dumped to landfill.
Yeah.
And that's not a good thing, of course. But there are moves in this country, I don't know about America, to phase out shopping bags, plastic shopping bags. And I think that's a good step along the way.
How many billion plastic shopping bags does the population of Australia, 20 million people, use in a year, Dr. Wright?
I don't have that figure.
Oh, you've got it in your book.
I know, isn't that awful? As soon as you said it, I thought, oh no.
It's billions, and if you tie them all together, they'd reach up to the moon and back.
That's right. I do remember writing that.
Yep. So I've advised people when they go to the shopping supermarket. Of course, it's supermarkets that are partly responsible for all this packaging, because when I was a girl, we had the grocer and we had the greengrocer and we had the butcher, and, there was no real packaging. The meat was wrapped in butcher's paper and then I think in newspaper. I advise people when they get to the counter in the supermarket to have their baskets and their string bags and the like, unpackage everything in front of the checkout person and put them all into your own bag and go home and leave all the mess. Well, the supermarkets would fairly quickly get the message, I think. I think that's one way of approaching it. But what did you learn, Dr. Wright, and your colleagues in writing this book? I'm interested in that because you're an engineer and, as you said, you think about big things, not little things. What did you learn?
Well, the thing, as I said before, the big message to me was just how much embodied greenhouse gas is in the goods and services and food. That was a real surprise to me. When we first started out, I thought, the electricity,
yep,
that's used in your house, mm, gas, mm, and the your car fuel would be the big,
yeah,
one. But they're not. Now, they're not insignificant. Put it that way. They
about 20% of the total greenhouse gas.
Well, you got 17% from energy, yeah, that you use, and another 9% in your car.
So that's 16%, and the rest is food, consumer services.
Yep.
Tell us what other things, apart from computers, that produce a huge amount of greenhouse warming, including flat-screen TVs. That fascinated me.
Flat-screen TVs are interesting, the
My
way
God.
They're evolving.
Yeah.
I must tell you, I bought one 2 weeks
you
ago.
You did, you naughty man.
Oh, well, I mean, we got rid of one to replace,
yeah,
it. And I actually cut the cord off it, because I had nowhere to really recycle it. So I'm looking into that at the moment. I've still got it in the shed.
Right.
and we looked around, and in the book it says it gives you all the levels of power taken by the various types,
yes,
of televisions. And there's a recommendation in the book. If it hasn't got an energy rating on it, a star rating we use in this country, have a look and see what the power consumption is. It'll be on the back mm-hmm. and on the label. So while my wife was looking at all the various types, I was around the back,
yeah.
and the salesman kept wondering while I was pulling them away from the wall, reading on the back. And our book says that anything lower than 150 watts is classed as low energy in the particular
150 watts.
Yeah.
Now, did you get a flat screen TV lower than that?
Yeah, 110.
Did because, you?
Oh, yes. They're getting better, I've got to say.
Huh?
And not before time. Certainly the big ones, this is only a small one, I think it's 26 inch.
Yeah.
Some of them are huge because they are very big energy consumers. So I was feeling very, very good about that and getting rid of the old one or stopping the other one from being used. That's the key. You can go on and buy television after television. If they're all used, then you're not really gaining anything.
Not at all. And the other important thing to note is that there's a gas, a fluorine gas, and I can't remember the name of it, that is used in the production of flat screen TVs, which is a potent global warmer, much more potent than CO2. And the global warming experts are becoming, the chemists, more and more concerned about the number of flat screen TVs that are being made and this gas that's escaping during their production. I think we should be aware of that.
We haven't looked into that, but it's something that sounds very interesting. And I think, I think we should look into that, yes.
Yeah, well, it's in my book.
I'll have to get a copy of your
and
book.
And my book's called If You Love This Planet, which you can get in Australia, and also it's published by Norton. I'm just trying to look up flat screen TVs here, but I'm not finding it. Tell us what other things that people buy that account for all that incredible energy use in a normal household.
Well, I'm afraid it's just about anything you buy.
Well, say, you know.
Any product at all.
Vacuum cleaners.
Well, appliances, all that sort of stuff. You can minimise the greenhouse gas from the appliance that you buy, you know, how it's made, and also by appropriate use of that appliance. When I say appropriate use, you come back to televisions and video recorders and that sort of stuff. And they use quite a lot of power when they're just sitting there on standby if they're switched on from the main.
Yeah, talk about that power. It's called, I can't remember the name of it, but in America, the power that's wasted by all these appliances being switched on at night
yes.
in sleep mode is about 6% of the electricity that's used in America. Is that so in Australia, Dr. Wright?
It's probably even higher here because we are a nation of electronic junkies, including myself.
Oh, are you?
Yes. Well, I've got the new TV and it's got video. It's got a video recorder and a tape recorder, and it uses probably about 10 watts with all that stuff just on standby. Now, if that's on 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, that's a very big power drain. We estimate in Australia you could save up to 10% of your electricity bill by switching off at the mains. And of course, I've got a computer system there with all sorts of modems and all that sort of stuff. And that's a drain too. So I've taken now to switching them off at the main when they're not used. Now, even the microwave we turn off at the mains because it's got a little clock in it. Now, we don't need that clock. We've got an analog clock on the wall, so we don't need two clocks going at once. And so we just turn off the microwave from the power point.
Yeah, I've got a clock on my electric oven that goes on all the time, and I don't know how to turn it off. I don't know where the switch is for that oven.
Well, there might not be one because a lot of the ovens use a lot of electricity. They use a lot of power, and they're permanently wired. Our stove is a combination gas.
Yeah, so is mine. A gas
cooktop. And we've got a plug that goes into the wall, so we can turn that off easily.
So, do you go around every night and switch off every appliance, Dr. Wright, before you go to bed?
Certainly, when I'm using the computer. When I stop for the evening, I turn it off.
Yeah, what else?
And when we've stopped watching television, I turn it off at the main. And they're easy to get to. I use a plug board.
Yeah.
You know, one power of those little boards.
Yep.
Yeah, power board. So you put that in a convenient location behind the television.
Yep.
You just click it off as you leave.
Yeah, yeah. I do that too. Now, what about lighting at night? I mean, many houses I know, and particularly in the United States, and even, you know, my grandchildren, leave their blasted lights on all the time. The house is consistently lit. People leave their garden lights on. I mean, you go to the cities and these skyscrapers are lit up during the night. I mean, it's personal responsibility, isn't it? And I think it's educating our children as well. I mean, I say to my granddaughter, Rachel, you're adding to global warming. Turn that blasted light off.
Yeah. We have minor little spats ourselves, and I might turn a light off, and my wife says, I'm just coming back in there, and vice versa, I've got to say.
Oh, well, you can learn to live with that. Now, what about heating and cooling, which is particularly relevant in the United States, particularly in the lower states? This program is broadcast out of KPFT in Houston, Texas, where it's stinking hot in the summer. And
yes,
you almost can't survive without an air conditioner.
Yes.
And then, of course, people in the northern states and in the south need heating in the winter. How can we make that much more efficient in terms of energy and CO2 production? And how can we fix our houses so that they don't leak heat or cold? How can we do that, Dr. Wright?
Well, there's a lot you can do now. In most of the populated areas of Australia, on average, it's a very temperate climate, and we've probably got our houses are much more leaky in terms of air ingress than perhaps in the States. But,
the States. I mean, I lived in Newton in Boston, and they're gorgeous old Victorian houses, 2 and 3 storey, and by God, they leaked like a sink. They were built, you know, in the 19th and 20th century, where oil was not a problem and greenhouse gas hadn't occurred.
Well, I lived in Toronto for a number
yes.
of years in a rented house, and it obviously gets extraordinarily cold over there for an Australian. And it was pretty good. It had double glazed windows and all those sorts of things. And I thought, oh, this is much better than insulated than my house in Australia. So I think it probably depends on the age of the house. I live in a 110-year-old house in Australia, and it's just a lovely summer house because it's got 4-metre ceilings, 16-foot ceilings. It's double brick, so it's got quite a lot of thermal mass. It's got a very highly pitched roof with a air vent in the centre of the highest spot. And in summer, it takes an awful long time before you have to even think about cooling it.
Mm.
But, of course, there are, you know, we have times of extended hot weather, and then it becomes more questionable.
But in days past, Dr. Wright, we just used to sweat. We didn't have air conditioners or coolers.
Well, that's true, but we're all softer these days.
No, but we needn't be. I mean, that's why we've got sweat glands to cool us from the latent heat of vaporisation.
Well, my wife said to me one day, in midsummer, when the humidity was way up, you're saying we've got to do something about this, or we're going to move. So what I did was we put in reverse cycle air conditioning.
Yep.
Heat pump.
Tell us about that.
Well, we used to heat the place using a couple of unflued gas heaters in the house, and then top that up with electric heating. And that was just wasteful of energy, no doubt about that. And when I looked around at all the heating and cooling systems, the heat pump system, if you want air conditioning and also heat the house, is much more efficient than either straight gas heating or particularly electric heating.
Why is it?
The heat pump's a wonderful device.
Yeah.
That,
how does it work?
Well, it shifts heat from one place to another. So with an electric heater, for example, you turn it on, electricity flows through a wire, the wire gets heated by that electricity, and it radiates the heat, and you can put an air blower on it to distribute the heat about. And that's quite efficient. But, of course, if you're dealing with coal-fired power, then it's only 30%, 35% efficient at the power station. So greenhouse gas emissions from that are really quite high. Mm. With a heat pump, you use the same amount of you use a lot less electricity for the same amount of heating, because the magic of the heat pump is that it's a heat transfer rather than a heat development.
What does that mean? So,
well, it'll take the heat from the air outside your home and transfer it into the home itself.
And how does it do that when it's a cold day?
Well, from a cold day, it's still there's still heat compared to a lower temperature. Now, that is probably the most efficient way to cool a house. And the reverse is even more efficient. It's a rather good heating system for a house. And then it'll take the heat from outside and move it inside. So it works both ways.
It's not really appropriate, though, for houses in the United States, because, you know, the whole house has to be heated in the middle of winter. I mean, or you'd die.
Well, that's right. But it is, compared to heating, burning oil, the house that we rented in Toronto had a big furnace in the basement.
Yeah.
And it worked on oil.
Yeah.
And it used to cost an arm and a leg even in those days.
Oh, it still does now. And peak oil has happened, I think. And, you know, how are people going to heat the houses when there's no oil? Or how are we going to live without oil? I mean, that's another huge subject that needs to be looked at. But how would you heat then a house, say, in New England in the middle of winter?
Well, I'd use a heat pump.
You'd use heat pumps?
Again.
Oh, yes. In each room?
No. You have a central unit.
Oh.
Ours is actually under the house.
Oh, is that so?
And it's ducted into each room.
Oh.
So you only heat those rooms that you live in.
Oh, that's interesting. And then you can cool the house as well.
That's absolutely. And it's called zoning. So if you've got a zoned heat pump system, you're starting to look pretty good in terms of energy use.
Well,
obviously, it's better if you could just slap on a few jumpers or take them off, depending on the
Americans
weather.
Americans don't call jumpers. They call them sweaters. Yeah. A jumper is a dress.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Sorry.
Yes. So you mustn't say up your jumper like we do in Australia, because that's not doesn't really work in America.
No, there's a few of those little tricks.
Yeah. Now, talk about double glazing of windows, Dr. Wright.
This was a contribution by one of the authors, Peter Osman, and I hadn't even thought about double glazing. I've got to admit. He said, "Oh, we're going to have double glazing," and I've seen lots of double glazing overseas. Not so common in this country because of our more benign climate, at least where I live. But there are a couple of examples in the book of people who have either put in double glazing, or they've done a sort of a home double glazing activity themselves, and it apparently has made a huge difference. Now, since then, and that would have been a lovely photograph from the book, but I didn't catch up with it quickly enough. I've seen lovely photographs of houses, photographs of houses taken with an infrared camera.
Mm.
And these photographs show the hotspots on the house, if you like. And Where heat's escaping.
Yeah.
And they show a comparison between a house with no insulation in the roof, and the roof is red because of all the heat coming out. And they show pictures of double glazed and single glazed windows.
Yeah.
And you can see in a very visually obvious way that the double glazed window is really locking that heat in, whereas the single glazed window in the photograph is blowing quite strongly. So they certainly make a difference.
And you can get, I see in your book, the CSIRO Home Energy Saving Handbook, that you can buy a plastic film, in fact, that you can apply to a single glazed window, which acts in a similar fashion to double glazing, two layers of glass. Is that right?
That's correct. The double glazing is quite expensive to put in. If you're building a new house, then it'd be great to do. Retrofitting is difficult because the window casement frames, you know, are not set up for that.
Yeah.
But if you're building a new house, and if I was building a new house, I'd be sorely tempted to look into double glazing.
Yep, even though it's expensive.
Even though it's expensive. Now, if you've got a problem with a window that's facing directly into the sun for a good part of its day, it's probably well worth looking into what kits are available to produce a home handyman double glazing solution to it.
Now, are those kits available in the United States, Dr. Wright?
I can't tell you that, I'm sorry. I just don't know.
Well, people can investigate that. Now, I want to get on now to solar energy, because the coal companies, the oil companies, in fact, ExxonMobil has spent millions of dollars in the past few years setting up think tanks with so-called scientists saying that renewable energy is far away, it will never produce baseload energy, and don't even think about it. Therefore, we have to use nuclear or coal or oil, and they are a set of lies. It's really what the tobacco companies did. They introduced doubt into the debate about whether or not tobacco causes lung cancer. Finally, I think as a medical profession, we've supervened that. But talk about solar power, both in individual houses where you have control over your own electricity and water heating, and then in general across Australia, which is a sunbathed land, Dr. Wright?
Well, let's restrict it to the household.
Right.
That was the easiest way. just as an aside, we're doing a lot of development work on large-scale solar electricity generation.
A thermal solar?
Yeah, solar thermal. And we've got a large power and heliostat field up here in Newcastle that we're developing quite nicely. So we'll just see how that goes in the future.
Good.
As far as a householder is concerned, an absolutely ideal way of utilising solar is hot water heating.
Mm.
Solar is a sunlight that falls is a fairly dilute form of energy. That's part of the difficulty in getting the cost down because it is so dilute. But we're only heating water to, I don't know what the conversion to Fahrenheit is. In this country, we'd say about 50, 60, 70 degrees Celsius, you know, about two-thirds the boiling point of water.
That's 100 degrees Fahrenheit.
Something like that. So that's what we're putting into our showers and our hot water systems. And solar is ideal for doing that. You can use just a simple flat plate collector. There's a series of pipes running through a dark background to absorb the sun's heat. And that'll work in most climates, even the very cold climates. If there's enough sun that comes through in the day, they'll produce a decent amount of solar energy. And these days, buying a solar energy water heater is pretty simple. They can be bought gas boosted or electricity boosted, so it guarantees hot water all year round. Even if it's been raining for a week, it'll switch over to using gas or electricity, and when the sun comes out, it'll use that solar power again, and it has the potential of reducing your hot water heating by 50, perhaps even up to 80%, depending on the type of climate.
Because electrical hot water systems use a hell of a lot of energy, don't they?
It's probably the most energy-intensive use of electricity in the household.
Why do they use so much electricity, Dr. Wright? You're an engineer.
Well, water is a fairly dense fluid.
Oh.
Simple as that. And if you were going to put down a fairly high heat capacity.
Mm-hmm.
So for every degree that you need to lift a litre of water, or every Fahrenheit degree you need to lift a gallon of water, just simply takes a lot of energy. And then once you've got it up there, it has to be held in a tank, so that when you and I turn on the shower, we demand that water comes through straight away. So it is quite expensive as well. better. Why is gas heating better? Because intrinsically it's a lower greenhouse gas emitting.
50% lower, I think, than
something
coal.
Something of that order.
Yep.
So gas heating would be the next step along the line.
And are we subsidised in Australia now for solar hot water systems, Dr. Wright, by the government? Are we?
Well, it depends what you call subsidised. In parts of Australia, hot water heating is what we call off-peak, so that in the middle of the night, 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning, signal is sent through the mains and electric hot water heaters are switched on. So they heat when the demand for power is down, and that's a cheaper rate. Now, that has all sorts of benefits for the...
But what about solar hot water systems? Are they subsidised?
Not that I'm aware.
So how much does a house, a solar...
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm misleading you there. In Australia...
Yeah.
The right at this current time, the government is offering a rebate for people who install solar hot water.
How much?
$1,600.
And how much does the whole thing cost in the first place?
Oh, it probably depends on the size.
About $3,000?
Be of that order.
Yes, so you get half of that back. Now, I think those subsidies are in the new energy bill, the Obama energy bill, and that will make it... I mean, I say that every single house in the United States should have a solar hot water system and a solar electricity system. All the parking lots, and there's a huge area of parking lots in America, should be covered with solar systems, and the electric vehicles, which they're now starting to make, can be plugged in during the day and be driven by renewable energy, not by coal-produced energy if you plug it into the mains in your house. This came, I'm just diverging a little, Dr. Wright, from a study that I actually commissioned in the United States done by Dr. Arjun Makajani, and it's called Carbon-Free, Nuclear-Free, and is he an engineer? Or a physicist. Anyway, he's a very brilliant scientist who worked with Jimmy Carter's science advisor in the White House years ago, Dr. David Freeman. And this study can be downloaded from IEER.org, and it goes into the available renewable energy technology now. It's all costed out, and it's all absolutely doable. I know that in Australia we subsidise the coal companies to the tune of millions of dollars a year. Why, I don't know. And we're subsidising the uranium companies, I think, also. And I think the same thing happens in the United States. Instead of subsidising those filthy industries, you know, we could be spending the money setting up a solar economy. And we haven't even talked about wind, both in the United States and Australia, which would employ hundreds of thousands of people and increase the GDP. Now, that was a little soliloquy. Would you like to comment, Dr. Wright? Sorry.
probably not. I'd like to keep on what the householder can do.
Oh, well.
Let me just come back to the solar. Yes, yeah. At the moment there is this package available. And I'm advising people that if their hot water heater, and they use electric, well, hot water heating is... getting a bit old,
right.
You know, if it's 10 years or more, it'd be a great time to switch over right now, because the last thing you want to have happen is that your hot water heater suddenly goes bang on you, and then you got to hunt around and get somebody to fix it, and you're left without hot water for a number of days.
So switch over to solar. So let's talk about solar electrical systems on houses, Dr. Wright,
mm-hmm.
and the subsidies that we can get from the government now. Can we?
You can, but there's a little proviso on that. Just come back to the solar power. The other thing is that in Australia you can get this rebate for either solar or for putting insulation in your roof.
Yeah.
You can come back and talk about insulation if you like, because I think that's a pretty important aspect. But as far as solar is concerned, if, for example, you wanted to put a photovoltaic array on your house, there is a process here that we call renewable energy certificates. And so there is some assistance there to put in photovoltaic panels on your roof.
How much does it cost to power a house, an average size house in Australia now with solar photovoltaic cells, Dr. Wright?
Depends. It's not cheap.
Yeah.
I've got to say, if you wanted to put in a 1 kilowatt panel, which is probably about the smallest you would, it's going to cost you something like $14,000.
That's a lot of money.
And you'll get back about $6,500 by selling your rec, $7,500, I think. So it cuts it down a bit. If you wanted to really go over the top and put in, say, 4 kilowatts, and that would just about cover all of your power use in an average home, it costs you something like $75,000.
Oh, my God.
Oh, yes, it goes up.
Oh, that's crazy.
It's quite expensive. And that also includes the cost of storing power in batteries. So it's not, you know, this is when you want to be fully independent of the grid, it's going to cost you something like that.
Well, is the cost of photovoltaic electricity going to go down? What is your prediction as an engineer, Dr. Wright?
Oh, yes, absolutely. The price of these things will come down. Two things. One is learning more about the technology and putting in base technology and the manufacturing expertise. As we get better, it'll come down.
Yeah.
But the biggest thing, of course, is scale. If we can produce a lot of these things,
mass produce,
then the price will come down.
Yeah.
And China, for example, is producing an array of solar panels. One of their principal developers was actually educated in Australia.
I know, Dr. Chi.
That's him. And he's got some very very big ideas and plans.
It's amazing, isn't it? Now, what about wind power?
Wind's difficult, I've got to say. Up here in Newcastle, we've got...
Where's Newcastle?
Newcastle is about 150 kilometres, 100 miles north of Sydney.
Yes.
North of Sydney on the coast.
Much of the coal from Australia is exported to China, right?
Newcastle is the biggest coal exporting port in the world.
Oh, my God. So it's a major global warming port.
And that's where we have our CSIRO Energy Centre.
Yes.
And the Energy Centre has photovoltaics all over it.
Yes.
And we have 3 wind turbines.
Yes. There's a photograph in your book, which looks fantastic.
Yes, a nice place.
Yeah.
And it's built to the highest possible energy efficiency standard. In fact, one of the most important energy-saving devices is you can open the windows, which is lovely. It's much better than being sealed up in the normal office block where
terrible.
You're just dependent on the air conditioning.
Yeah, that's so right.
We've got a lot of things like that. But we have 3 wind turbines up here. They're relatively small. They're 60 kilowatts each, but... And we monitor these all the time and use them for all sorts of renewable energy experiments. But I've got to say, for the householder, you really need to live in a windy part of the country put up with the intermittency of the wind. And you can do that, but they're probably a relatively expensive option because of all the moving parts. They need maintenance and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
Whereas a photovoltaic cell... It's got no moving parts. It just sits there. And our photovoltaics that we use here in Newcastle have worked perfectly from day one. And they require virtually no maintenance at all. Our wind turbines are a different matter. They need to be constantly maintained.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a bit of a learning curve for us as to how wind turbines work. But of course, having said all that, there are domestic wind turbines on the market. And if you talk to any person who sails yachts, for example, they know all about these things.
Yes.
Because they mount them on the yachts.
Yes.
In fact, the combination of a wind turbine and a photovoltaic cell on a yacht is a pretty good combination.
Yeah, it provides all their electricity. I've just found out about that.
Yeah, and we show in the book a couple of photographs of houses with wind turbines. They look pretty spacey, a bit elaborate, but... Nonetheless, it's a possibility.
Well, there are some states in America. There's enough wind west of the Mississippi to supply the whole country with electricity. enough wind power. The only problem is that the grids need to be upgraded to transport that electricity to the eastern states and to California and the like. But South Dakota, the Dakotas are incredibly windy. And I know that Congress and those states are starting to look very seriously at wind power now.
Yes, the it's the usual curse of renewables, the variability of the power,
yeah.
And you're quite right about the grid. Our grid has not been built in Australia to suit variability.
No.
But I suppose the good news is that we're onto that, and we now have quite a large program in CSIRO looking at what we call a smart grid. And we're doing that simply because we know that renewables are going to come into the electricity market in ever-increasing quantities. It's going to give us a supply which is much more variable than it is now, and we need to be prepared for that and make the best use of it. So energy efficiency, we're lost without it.
Yeah.
The International Energy Agency, we agree with them, are talking about energy efficiency reducing
yeah.
our greenhouse gas emissions by up to 30%, can be even higher at times. And it's virtually free reduction.
Oh, of course.
But we need the systems to do it.
Yeah.
Now, you could go one step further, and this gets into the sort of Big Brother era, that if an area is, say, very hot, and the everybody's turned on their air conditioning and it's reaching a peak, and the grid is just about ready to die, normally there would be a blackout. But under a smart grid, they'd say, oh, we can't get any power from other regions at the moment, and we're approaching criticality in this particular area. The substation is heating up and it's about ready to go down. Let's turn everybody's air conditioning back in that area.
Oh, what a good
1
idea.
Degree.
Ah.
Just 1 degree, not for long, an hour maybe, get us over the peak, and we can get power from this other district that they know there's a wind front coming through, for example. I'm speculating here. But that's the sort of thing that the grid does, because it knows what's happening everywhere. And it can make those adjustments.
Smart grid.
And it'll adjust things. You wouldn't notice whether your air conditioning went down another degree for an hour or so. And they could make those adjustments.
Oh, what a good idea. We have no time now, Dr. Wright. I really thank you for this conversation, which is applicable to countries all over the world, and particularly the United States and Australia and Canada. This has been absolutely fascinating, exciting, and optimistic, Dr. Wright, and I thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Helen. I do appreciate the opportunity to talk about the book.
Yes. Okay. Thanks very much.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye. My guest today was Dr. John Wright, the Executive Advisor to the CSIRO's Sustainable Energy Partnership, one of the three authors of the new book, the CSIRO Home Energy Saving Handbook. The book is published by Pan Macmillan in Australia, and you can find out more about it or purchase a copy by going to panmacmillan.com.au or csiro.com. Thanks for listening today. I thought it was quite a fascinating discussion, and we'll be talking more next week.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.